The next case is Z7492, Disciplinary Counsel versus Carol H. Squire. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I represent Judge Carol Squire, respondent in this disciplinary matter. There are three issues I would like to raise and have the court consider. First, I consider it a very fundamental and threshold question, and that is, should decisions and rulings of a judge of a specialized court, such as the domestic relations court, on issues that lie within the sound professional and personal discretion of said judge, be subject to ethical sanctions? The second issue is where there are disputes over the correctness of the rulings and decisions of a judge of a specialized court, is it within the province of a non-appellate ethics body to pass on the manner in which such discretion was exercised? And the third issue is, does the conduct of a judge in passing on issues presented to the court, and the judge has exercised judgment which law in instances reposed to the personal and professional discretion of said judge, become the subject of ethical sanctions? An answer to those questions, I think we'll find in the most recent Model Code of the ABA Judicial Code of Judicial Conduct that was approved last February by the American Bar Association at its convention. And if we analyze this record and analyze these sanctions with these amendments to the Model Code of the American Bar Association as just approved, I think you will conclude that the recommendations for sanctioning Judge Squire should be rejected. Those amendments to the ABA Code provide new guidance for the evaluation of conduct of judges of specialized courts, because the ABA and the Code, those who drafted the amendments, recognize that we have evolved into there has been a development with regard to the new courts, the specialized courts, courts that deal with problems of the kind that we have in our drug courts and our juvenile courts, our domestic relations courts, where you're solving problems, that it's inappropriate to take those decisions and transfer them into the ethical realm.
But Mr. Jones, let me just stop you for a moment. Our court has imposed discipline on juvenile court judges in the case of Judge Ferrari. We've imposed sanctions against Judge O'Neill on the appellate court for similar kinds of judicial activity undertaken in an official capacity. Why should we segregate this particular case apart from what we've done in the Carteau case, in the Ferrari case, or in the O'Neill case?
A review of the record, Your Honor, Justice O'Donnell, I think will reveal a clear dissimilarity between the complaints that were filed with regard to Judge O'Neill and Judge Carteau. those were totally different from what we have here. In this instance, we have conduct that was complained about in the combat of litigation, where a judge was faced with decisions with regard to contentions that were presented by the parties. The answer and the remedy for the conduct complained of is not to invoke the ethical rules, but to use the appellate rules. If there are errors of law, if there are errors of facts, if there's an error in the construction of a statute, if there's a misapplication of a rule, then those matters should be addressed on appeal and not convert the decisions made by judges who are exercising power reposed in a judge. And that's what the ABA amendment rules point out. And I refer you to the preamble of the model code that states that although a judge may be disciplined only for violating a rule, the canons provide important guidance in interpreting the rules. And it goes on to, the model code goes on to state that you must apply rules of reason, and that the care must be taken not to impinge upon the essential independence of judges in making judicial decisions. And that therein lies a difference. The preamble to the model code also points out that it is not contemplated that every transgression will result in an imposition of a discipline. Whether a discipline should be imposed should be determined through a reasonable and reasoned application of the rules, and should depend upon factors such as the seriousness of the transgression, the facts and circumstances that existed at the time of the transgression, and the extent of any pattern of improper conduct. And what I'm submitting here today for your honors is that what you are confronting is a labyrinthian process, or to use an analogy that you may find non-judicial, an omelet. We have a lot of things thrown into a skillet, and the Judicial Council has put them all together into the skillet and has presented them to a panel to say these are ethical violations without sorting out what the ABA is concerned about. And I must note here that Chief Justice Moyer has seen the wisdom of appointing a 17-member task force to analyze and study this model code, which is designed to improve the...
Counsel, that's just it. It's a model code that has not been adopted by the Supreme Court for the conduct of the judiciary. We have the code under which that is in place now, and under that code, that's what our guidelines are.
Well, that's very true, Your Honor, but I'm sure this court wants to be right. And where you have the American Bar Association and the commission, its standing commission on ethics, which provides the gold plate for ethical conduct. And I say that because in my other life, I served 8 years as a member of the Codes of Conduct Committee of the Judicial Conference of the United States, covering dealing with the conduct of all federal judges throughout the country. And we applied in our work the ABA standards in measuring and evaluating the conduct of federal judges who are there for life and who you cannot get rid of except for a proof of a conduct that's violative of the code. Here in this situation, we have a different format. We have a situation in which the public can interject itself periodically to evaluate the conduct of judges. If the bar associations and the other monitors of judicial conduct feel that a judge should not be retained on the bench, we have an elective process that takes care of that situation. So when you when you're dealing with the conduct, evaluating the conduct of a lawyer as opposed to a judge, there has to be a different standard, and that's what the model code of the ABA is seeking to do. And let me just, I should have
counsel,
asked.
Counsel, are you saying that the allegations that were leveled and the findings, the 40 violations of the canons of the Code of Judicial Conduct and the 12 violations of the disciplinary rules of the Code of Professional Responsibility would have no place in the model code that you are proposing we use?
No, no, Your Honor.
So are you saying that there's absolutely no violations here and that this conduct that is complained of is merely an exercise of judicial and personal discretion in the context of domestic relations operations?
No, Justice O'Connor, I'm not saying it. I'm not saying there's an absolute prohibition against scrutinizing the conduct of judges of specialized courts. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying that the standard of review, the standard of measuring that conduct must be totally different, because the ABA points out that it's not contemplated that every decision that is made by a judge in that context, even if it's wrong, should be an ethical violation. It can be measured by other standards that we use in our appellate process.
And is that the basis, your understanding of the basis for the complaints here, that there was wrong legal rulings by the court?
I'm saying there were rulings by the court which were called into question, which were used by the Ethics Council as a basis for claiming ethical violations. I'm saying some of those claims, some of those rulings, some of those decisions should have been reviewed, as was the case in two of the instances, two of the four cases, where there were appeals taken to the Court of Appeals and the issues were resolved and returned to the trial court, to the judge in question for resolution. One was compromised and the other led to a resolution of the issue that was in dispute. What I'm saying, Justice O'Connor, is that we have a different situation today than we had prior to the time the claims were filed. There is recognition on the part of the persons who study this issue of ethics that great care must be taken that we don't convert decisions made by a judge of a tribunal who has discretion, and in the exercise of that discretion, to have that considered to be ethical violations. I'm sorry, I should have asked the reserve 2 minutes for a rebuttal if I'm not too late.
About 2 minutes, a little more than 2 minutes remaining.
So what I'm urging this court to consider as you weigh the sanctions imposed here, the panel recommended a year with 6 months stayed. The board doubled that. Now, the conduct complained of here was conduct as a judge. So why and how is the public protected, or how does the public benefit, as the Ethics Council argued, by having that judge suspended as a lawyer? The conduct complained of was not as a lawyer, but as a judge. And I think the public record shows she is no longer a judge.
Just the value of, if we would decide to adopt the recommendation of the board, the value of that would be as a reminder to other judges, all of our judges, that judicial temperament, courtesy, not threatening people with contempt, not shouting at lawyers and parties, that's a very important element of being a judge. You're a very distinguished federal judge, and you've seen lawyers certainly that you think, well, this conduct is not quite what it ought to be. But if we follow the findings of the panel and the board, it seems there's a pattern here. I think that's what that's what concerns me. There's a clear pattern. It's not just one erupting in a domestic. There's no question, as you say, domestic relations cases are very difficult. The parties aren't happy. Sometimes the lawyers aren't happy, and it's a cauldron. But the judge, it seems to me, has to maintain his or her role as a judge, and that sometimes means a peacekeeper. Sometimes means having more patience than Job. That's right. But that's the role of a judge, and there are domestic relations judges across this state who are faced with the same situation or circumstances with which Judge Squire was faced in her role as a judge. My other concern is that if there is not a sanction here, that, and I know you're not arguing, I think you're not arguing for no sanction, but okay. If there's not a sanction, it seems to me that the public, citizens who have to use the courts to resolve their disputes, anyone seeing the conduct of the respondent here as a judge would have to be appalled and have to think, how can that person be fair and impartial? And that, to me, is the underlying issue. That again, if the facts are accurate, as the board says, one would have to think, I wouldn't want that person judging my case because of the way she conducts herself. It's not a matter of making rulings that are overruled by a court. It's the way in which the judge conducts herself with the parties and with the lawyers in the courtroom, it seems to me.
May I just make two points
sure.
of response?
Your red light's on, but Chief you can
Justice,
answer anything
lawyer.
You want.
I do not quarrel with your analysis of the interests that are involved here. And since you've made reference to my former life, I hope the court won't take offense if I draw upon a little of that experience. In many instances, we reviewed cases that raised the issue of the temperament and the of a trial judge, and whether the judge deported him or herself in an inappropriate way so as to influence the outcome of a case. And we often, and I would be in dissent, but I would often make the point that a judge has to be fair to the parties and must display the kind of temperament that will attract the confidence of litigants in the public. I agree with that. What I'm arguing here today is that those issues can be raised in the appellate channel, and they should not be ipso facto converted into ethical violations. If there are extremes taken, if there is conduct that parties are objecting to and there's concern, if they impact upon the administration of justice and upon the ability to be fair to the parties, those present issues, and I know I got in this case very late, but I've tried to absorb as much of the record as I could. The issues that I have noted that were identified and are in these four cases that pose the basis of the sanctions, they deal with issues of rulings, of statutory construction, of interaction between lawyers and a lawyer's demeanor before a judge that a judge found objectionable and felt that it invaded the judge's ability to control the courtroom, objections to feelings that there were outside influences, that lawyers were going behind the judge's back, strategizing with other judges on the court as to how to handle matters that were pending before this judge. These are all matters that I think you have to consider, because to the extent that there was legal error or factual errors, they should be presented to an appellate court and resolved in that fashion, and they should not be considered ethical violations. And secondly, they certainly should not be the basis of suspending a person as a lawyer. A judge takes what is presented, just as you, members of this court, have to rule on matters that are presented to you. Judges take cases that are on their dockets. And as a result, they are distinguishable. That function is distinguishable from a private practitioner or a lawyer or litigator who can pick and choose clients and decide who he or she will represent and who he or she will not represent. But to then go from evaluating one's conduct as a judge, exercising discretion, maybe erroneously, maybe in the extreme, in ways that we do not find commendable. Nevertheless, that should not be the basis of finding an ethical violation and then suspending that person as a lawyer, not as a judge. That person is out, is off the bench. The public is no longer dealing with that person as a judge. But to then say to that person, you're going to pay an economic price by not being able to practice your profession, given the reality that we all know, and there's a reality I think we have to face, that there's been a long struggle to diversify the legal profession racially and to diversify the bench racially. And therefore, we must be very careful and cautious and sensitive that we are going to disturb that level of attainment and achievement that we've reached. We must be very careful that we don't cut corners and don't use procedures that are drawn in that are highly questionable, which in this case, I contend the use of ethics will do. And so I would urge the court to look very carefully at what the model rules are trying to get at, because there have been other instances where it has been contended that judges have the conduct of judges have been in the gray area, and that in order to ensure that we don't blur the lines, that we don't impose sanctions of suspension from the profession as a means of correcting what we deem to be inappropriate judicial conduct.
You need to sum up, Mr. Jones.
And so I ask this court, and I'm sure you will take this responsibility seriously as you will as judge of this very very significant court. And I urge that you either reject outright the recommendation of the board of grievances, or modify it to ensure that this respondent is not penalized economically as a lawyer for decisions she made as a judge. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Judge Jones. Ms. Brown.
Ms. Brown, before you get rolling, I do want to take you to the bottom line, and Judge Jones brought us to that. The board's recommendation, it says, after much discussion, that the panel, as you know, recommended 12 months with 6 months stayed. The board said, after much discussion, recommends the respondent, Judge Carol Squire, be suspended from the practice of law for a period of 2 years with 1 year stayed. The board's reason is that given the extent and nature of the judicial misconduct seriously affecting the administration of justice, a longer suspension is required for the protection of the public.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, didn't the election process take care of the protection of the public issue in terms of this judge?
I don't believe it did, Your Honor. Yes, and as Judge Jones mentioned, Carol Squire was defeated in the November election.
Yes.
She no longer serves as a judge in Franklin County.
When did the board make this? I see when it was filed with us, but when did they decide this case?
All I would know, Your Honor, is when it was filed with you. I don't know whether it was decided at an earlier meeting and how the opinion ultimately came, the board's recommendation came to this court.
Because the filing date would indicate this is done well after the election.
It would indicate that, yes, Your Honor. This is a situation much like the O'Neill case. This court in the O'Neill case said that in order to decide the sanction, the court must look at the nature of the violations. It must look at respondent's mental state, the injuries caused, the aggravating and mitigating circumstances, and precedent. And I ask you to look at precedent when you consider whether the respondent's law license should be suspended, separate and apart from whether she should serve as a judge. Second, I need to emphasize for the court the fact that under Ohio rules, as opposed to some other states, where a lot of other states have sanctions such as public censure or removal from the bench, Ohio has chosen to follow rules which have sanctions that are somewhere in between that. They have public reprimand to permanent disbarment and any suspension in between that. Now, this court has routinely, if the violations warrant an actual suspension, in the Ferrari case, in the Carto case, in the O'Neill case, for example, there are many others, an actual suspension of the law license. Further, the respondent in this case was found to have violated DR1-102A4, which is dishonesty, deceit, and misrepresentation. That violation on its own, on two occasions, one in count three and one in count four, warrants an actual suspension from the practice of law. And I believe, as Justice O'Connor pointed out in the first part of this argument.
I guess my question is getting to a year out versus 6 months. The publicity surrounding this case clearly would have had some influence on the judge's reelection effort. So there was the death sentence imposed by the voters.
Your Honor, I don't.
As a result of publicity about this case and her conduct. So now the question becomes, how much sanction, how much time out?
And pardon me for interrupting. Yeah. There are several different considerations, as I pointed out. Let's start with the aggravating and mitigating circumstances. This is not a respondent who came to the hearing and said, you know what, I was wrong. I violated the Code of Judicial Conduct when I did A, B, and C.
Well, you wouldn't expect, I mean, the judges that get hauled into discipline are people with big elbows and sharp personalities to begin with. They rub lawyers the wrong way. They rub colleagues the wrong way, and it's always a slippery slope in terms of deciding where does it go beyond a tough personality and get into something that should be considered an ethical violation. And it isn't too hard to imagine that while others, including the panel and the board and colleagues, feel there have been serious ethical breaches, that this judge, given her personality, and I don't know her, but just reading, felt righteously indignant about being even called before anyone to respond for the conduct in question.
And that may very well be true, Your Honor, but I believe that an analysis of the record in this case will show you that, righteous indignity or not, there were clear violations. There is no question that, for example, let's talk about count one, just as an example. There are instances of violations of the Code of Judicial Conduct in that count that are patently obvious from the record. Now, the respondent was not a person to undertake any self-examination whatsoever of her conduct in that case, be it misconduct or plain conduct. It is not a person who, in fact, when you evaluate the transcript in this case, during cross-examination, it became painfully clear that the respondent had not reviewed the transcripts prior to her testimony. She had not reviewed the evidence. She had not looked at the documents. You will see an individual who did not take the time to evaluate what the charges were against her. And I believe that if you'll notice in respondent's objections and relator's answer, there is some misunderstanding to this day of what the violations were. It is not whether she recused herself from certain cases, but the time period in which she had the opportunity to do so and chose wrongfully not to recuse herself at the time she was first asked, when her bias and prejudice became obvious to anyone looking at the transcripts, anyone being in the courtroom. And Judge Jones, in his argument to this court, makes it appear as though respondent's misconduct was limited to abuses of judicial discretion. That is not at all the case. In fact, there are six areas of misconduct. Respondent engaged in repeated ex parte communication. Respondent abused her judicial power. Let's take the legal errors as an example mentioned by Judge Jones. Respondent's legal errors, he suggests, should be appealed. Some of those legal errors amounted to no decisions at all. In fact, in count one and in count two and in count three, actually, and in count four too, respondent delayed her decisions. She had the opportunity, for example, in Brent Patterson's CPO on November 5th to make a decision, yes or no. She didn't do it. She didn't hold a hearing like the statute requires. She made no decision. There was nothing to appeal. So to argue that we are suggesting the board has recommended that she be sanctioned for her judicial decisions, that's not exactly correct. These were not decisions she made. She was intemperate to those individuals who appeared in her courtroom, and her intemperance was not limited to the lawyers. It expanded to the litigants. Take Teresa Allison, for example. When Judge Squire forced Teresa Allison to present her case pro se, she would not allow Ms. Allison to check the hallway for her witnesses. She would not allow Ms. Allison's lawyers to go into the hallway and check for documents or check for witnesses. These are individuals who were essentially captives in her courtroom and were subjected to judicial intemperance. The situations involving dishonesty, Judge Squire had plenty of opportunities to make the judgment entries that she authored correct, accurate, and truthful. All she had to do was look at the record. By making representations in a judgment entry that was, and those in particular, could not have been appealed. They were entries recusing herself from all the cases involving Rick Innes and all of Kim Halliburton-Cohen's cases. Neither Ms. Halliburton-Cohen or Mr. Innes had any recourse for those judgment entries. In the absence of the disciplinary hearing, they had to sit and essentially take it. They had to be called. In the particular instance involving Mr. Innes, he was accused of conspiring, if you will, with Judge Price to create a judgment entry and then create a letter detailing Judge Squire's alleged misconduct. None of that ever happened. So Judge Squire had opportunities to be accurate, to be correct, and she made the wrong choices. Her choices amounted to misconduct. And for those reasons, the voluminous number of violations, as pointed out by Justice O'Connor, 40 violations of the Code of Judicial Conduct.
Ms. Brown, may I take you to a different area? I think during the presentation of Mr. Jones' argument, he suggested that we ought not to sanction a lawyer for conduct committed as a jurist and deprive that economic loss to that individual. Is there some precedent that you can tell us that that's been done before, or what is your response to that argument that this was done while the individual was serving on the bench but no longer there?
If I understand your question, Justice O'Donnell, let me answer it this way. This was a GovBar Rule 5 proceeding brought pursuant to the rules of the judiciary, Rule 2, Roman numeral 2. The only other possibility in the state of Ohio is a Judiciary Rule 3 proceeding, which is a removal proceeding under circumstances that did not apply in this case. So we brought, because we had violations of the disciplinary rules, as well as the Code of Judicial Conduct, our proceedings with the Board of Commissioners entailing a hearing before a full panel and then before the board, this is the procedure we followed. The only result, if you will, is to affect the status of a lawyer's law license. This isn't about removing a judge from a bench. This is a proceeding, and the rules allow for this.
Has there been decisions out of our court disciplining individuals who have left the bench?
Who have left the bench?
Yes.
Judge O'Neill, for example.
So there is some precedent
for
what you're asking us to consider in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. Judge O'Neill was a candidate for a different court at the time. Had she been elected, she was not. So, I mean, I'm a little outside the record here, but and there are decisions of this court in which a judge has been disciplined while serving as a judge. That judicial term ended, and their law license remained suspended until they got their law license back. You know, those are situations. The rules allow, and obviously, if you can't be a judge in Ohio unless you're a lawyer, with the exception of Mayor's Court, but we won't talk about that right now.
Well.
But this is a situation where, under our proceedings, and GovBar Rule 5, Judiciary Rule 2, and precedent allows for this court to suspend a law license. This is a case in which the respondent's license to practice law should be suspended because of the nature of the violations, because of the volume of the violations, the aggravating and mitigating circumstances, all call for nothing less than what the board recommended, with a 24-month suspension with 12 months stayed. Thank
Ms.
you,
Brown, Your Honor. One fact that was mentioned in the board's recommendation that caught my attention, well, one of many, it was the locking of her courtroom. That was to prevent a lawyer from entering the courtroom, or was that, do you remember that reference in the?
Are you talking about the count, in count two, when Susan Lance returned to her courtroom, or the placing the child in her chambers?
I don't remember which one it was. I just remember that the rather, well, I thought it was rather extraordinary conduct. Oh, here it is. And, paragraph 165 in there in the board's recommendation. Respondent was on the bench in a hearing when Lance attempted to enter the courtroom and deliver the motion. Respondent's bailiff told her the court wasn't open for business, refused to accept the motion, locked the courtroom, and told Lance to come back later.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe that paragraph is a symptom of a larger group, if you will, of violations. And it's unprecedented in the transcript. It's unrebutted, unchallenged. Respondent was tired of Susan Lance coming to her courtroom. She was advocating for her client. The reason she had to keep coming back to the courtroom was because respondent would not make a decision. She would not rule on the CPO initially, and then she would not civil protection order, and then she would not rule on the emergency custody order. There were matters pending before respondent in which Susan Lance was involved. She kept coming back to the courtroom. It is without question that respondent got tired of it. She locked the courtroom door.
There were instances where maybe it's just my lack of knowledge about the practice, but it seemed to me some of the documents that the counsel were taking directly to the judge would have been filed in the clerk's office and then given to the judge. But was that a chance that maybe the judge was a little aggravated by the fact they weren't filing documents in the clerk's office?
No, it's a little bit of a, I don't want to call it an unusual practice because I'm familiar with the Franklin County Domestic Relations Court and the particular cases that make up this disciplinary matter. For example, in the civil protection orders, those petitions are filed in the clerk's office, handed back to the lawyers or the parties if they're pro se, and taken up to the courtroom. Similarly with, for example, Susan Lance filed a motion requesting that Judge Squire recuse herself from the case. The clerk's office would not even accept it for filing until she presented it to the bailiff and got it on the schedule. Then she took it down to be filed. Then she brought it back up. It's a little bit of a process that the lawyers are used to, and the judges, each of them has their own system, as I understand it. But that wasn't an issue.
I didn't see any indication where she suggested the lawyer go file in the clerk's office, so I guess that wasn't one of her defenses.
No, Your Honor. That being said, I urge the court to adopt the board's recommendation of a 24-month suspension with 12 months stayed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Judge Jones, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Chief Justice Moyer and the members of the court, I'd like to just comment on the argument with regard to the ex parte issue. Model Rule 2.9 clearly states that in specialized courts, it is necessary and encouraged at times that judges engage in ex parte communications in order to attempt to resolve the issues that are before the court. And with regard to the precedent that was cited of Judge O'Neill, That was a clear case of apples and oranges. Judge, the only similarity is they both were members of the Franklin County Common Pleas Court. The facts are totally different, and the course of conduct totally different, and it cannot be considered as a precedent. Regard to locking the courtroom, that incident occurred during a lunch hour when someone sought to enter the courtroom during a lunch hour. The bailiff had locked the courtroom, and they were and told the lawyers to return after lunch, at which time the court would be in business. So there, the problem here is if we get into the minutiae.
Counsel, before you go too much further, is there any justification for a judge to refuse to allow something to be put on the record in the courtroom?
Well, as a former litigator, I would say no.
Thank you.
But as a judge, I know that it often happens, and that it's not an ethical question.
But it's not.
It's a basis for which an appeal can be taken, and that matter dealt with in the appellate route, and not as an ethical matter. That's not an ethical issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge Jones. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Counselor, excuse. We have an admission ceremony following oral arguments. Unless you'd like to stay and watch the admission ceremony, you're welcome to do that. Our procedure on the admission of the bar ceremony is I will ask each presenter to come forward as I call your name, and please state briefly why you believe the applicant you're representing would make an excellent member of the Bar of Ohio. I'd ask that the applicants please stand in place so we can identify you. At the end of the presentations, I'll ask Justice Pfeiffer to administer the oath of office. The first presenter is John Jeffers.
If it pleases the court, I'm John Jeffers. I've been a member of the bar for 43 years here in Ohio, member of Weston Heard, and it's my distinct pleasure to introduce today David Black, a fellow Marine, and a member of the Presidential Guard, who is practiced in Pennsylvania and Texas, and is now here on a waiver, hoping to be admitted to practice in the state of Ohio. He also is a member of Weston Heard in Cleveland, Ohio, and I wish to submit his name, and I can vouch for him, particularly in two realms, as a Marine and as a fellow lawyer.
Thank you. Thank you. John Stavridis.
May it please the court, my name is John Stavridis. I've been a member of the bar since November of 1985. I have had the pleasure of knowing Mr. Mark Brown for the past 4 years. In this time, I've come to appreciate him as a good friend and neighbor who is conscientious, intelligent, and honorable. It is these qualities of his that I believe can only enhance the integrity of the Ohio Bar, and it is my privilege to present him to you this day for admission into the Ohio Bar.
Thank you. Andrew Krims.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Krems. I'm an attorney in Ohio, practicing in Cleveland. I'm here as a presenter, a proud presenter of Kirk Klaunch from Texas. I've known Kirk actually only for the past year. However, I can tell you I've worked with him in a number of cases, and he is an extremely competent and honorable attorney. He has been in practice for 16 years, 15 of those years with his father in a firm in Fort Worth, Texas. He is now with the firm of Barron and Budd in Dallas, Texas, and has cases throughout the United States. He's also licensed in the state of Wisconsin, the state of my birth. But that being said, aside from his practice, he is also a major in the Army Reserve. He served in the first, not the first Gulf War, but the first year of the latest war in Iraq. He is still in the Army Reserves and still climbing that ladder as well. It is with great pleasure that I present to this court and ask the admission of Kirk Klontch.
Thank you. Michael Biting.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Michael Biting. I'm Associate General Counsel for First Energy. It's my pleasure to recommend the admission of one of my distinguished colleagues, David Jenkins. Mr. Jenkins is a graduate of George Washington University School of Law. He has been practicing law for approximately 20 years. He is a member in good standing of the bar of the state of Illinois, Maryland, and Michigan. I believe he would make an outstanding addition to the Ohio bar.
Thank you. Henry Holtz, the second.
May it please the court, my name is Henry Holtz. I go by Val Holtz. I practice in Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and it's my great privilege to be admitted to the bar of the great state of Ohio. Today I wish to present to you for admission Scott Miller, a fine man. He has submitted a rather voluminous set of credentials to you, and upon that, I would enthusiastically recommend that he be admitted. Thank you.
Thank you. Gordon Hobson, Jr.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Gordon Hobson. I've been a member of the Bar of Ohio for 27 years, and I would today move for the admission of Frederick Mullins. He is an attorney. He's been admitted in the state of Florida for 12 years. He is a graduate of the Virginia School of Law. I work at the Federal Public Defenders here in Columbus, and Mr. Mullins has recently joined our office in Dayton, and I would move the admission. Thank you.
Thank you. Mark Meeks.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mark Meeks. I've been an attorney in the state of Ohio since 1988. Today I present for application to the bar Marjan Nisecki. I have known Mr. Nisecki for 9 years when he hired with our firm in our Buffalo office. He has been admitted in New York since 1996. We moved him to the Toledo office to do Michigan work, and he's been admitted in Michigan since 2006. During the time that I've known him, I have found him to be an upstanding and ethical lawyer, and it is without reservation that I present him for admission today. Thank you.
Thank you. Lewis Williams, Jr.
May it please the court, my name is Lewis Williams with the law firm of Steptoe Johnson. I am here to submit Christopher Slaughter for membership in the Ohio Bar. I have known Chris for 5 years, have worked with him on a daily basis. He is an excellent lawyer and an excellent person.
Thank you. Brooke Elliott.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Brooke Elliott. I'm a member in good standing with the Ohio Bar. I'm currently an associate at Riley Hewitt Witte & Romano in Pittsburgh, PA. I'm here today to present Mr. William J. Witte. He is a partner in the law firm that I work for. He has been a member of the Pennsylvania Bar since 1995 and a member of the West Virginia Bar since 2000. I have the distinct honor and pleasure to present him today. He is an outstanding attorney that I have the pleasure of working with. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a motion that the applicants be admitted to the Bar of Ohio?
So moved.
Hearing no objection, the applicants will please come forward and string out along the first step there, if you will. Justice Pfeiffer.
In the administration of the oath, I will use the word swear. However, if you prefer, you may substitute the word affirm. Raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, and state your name.
I, Martin Chesky.
Hereby swear. That I will support the Constitution and laws of the United States. And the Constitution and laws of Ohio. And I will abide by the Ohio rules of professional conduct. In my capacity as an attorney and officer of the court. I will conduct myself with dignity. Civility. And show respect toward judges. Court staff. Clients.
Fellow professionals,
and all other persons. I will honestly, faithfully, and competently discharge the duties of an attorney at law. So help me God. Congratulations.
On behalf of the court and the Bar of Ohio, I extend our congratulations. We have a very strong bar in Ohio. We're proud of our bar, and we hope it's better now that you are members. Good luck. Marshal, please adjourn court.